You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I'm delighted to say that my guest today is the author of this week's Book of the Week, A Child of One's Own, Parental Stories. I'm joined today by Professor Rachel Bowlby, who is the Northcliffe Professor of English at University College London. Welcome.
Thank you, Karen. Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. I thought it was interesting that we're meeting in our offices in Holborn, not far from where the Foundling Museum was, which is Thomas Coram's invention and something that you mention in this book.
Yes, that's a lovely way to begin, because actually the picture that's on the cover of the book is a picture by Hogarth, which hangs in the Foundling Museum. It's called Moses Brought Before Pharaoh's Daughter, and it shows the woman who is actually Moses' own birth mother, but who's apparently only his wet nurse, bringing the toddler Moses to the princess, the Pharaoh's daughter, for her to adopt him. And so she's giving up the baby, which is in fact her very own baby. And it was a symbol in the Foundling Museum, when the Foundling Museum was the Foundling Hospital for foundlings, of that transition that the boys and girls who lived there made from being brought up in the country by foster mothers, wet nurses, to coming to live in the Foundling Hospital itself. So it's a sort of emblem of handing over a baby from one mother to another without it being clear which of them is the real mother, and if there is a real mother at all. And that's kind of a central theme of the book, really, the notion of babies or children passing between two parents, and a question about who is the real parent, if indeed either of them is.
This is a book of two halves, as footballers might like to put it. I was extremely impressed that what I expect from a literary scholar would be perhaps what I saw in the second half of the book, where you look at Silas Marner, Tom Jones, Mansfield Park, Great Expectations, Medea, and consider parenting. I was somewhat surprised that there was a whole first half of the book that really encapsulates what we always assume scholars are aiming to do, which is a sort of interdisciplinary focus, but I suspect in reality is quite hard to get away with. And here you're looking at the changes in reproductive technology and what that means about parenthood. Were you concerned that doing a book in this way would make it problematic in terms of its reception or selling the book?
No, that's
convincing a publisher.
No, that's a
explaining to your colleagues who understand that you'd be looking at Silas Marner but might be a bit startled that you were considering in vitro fertilization.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, and it's probably the two halves of me. And I mean, it's funny, as you were asking it, I'm thinking Sussex University, because that was the place where I had my first job. And in a way, Sussex was that kind of doubleness, because at the time Sussex was divided into schools on the one hand and subjects or majors on the other hand. And so you were both teaching a traditional subject like English or literature not in a traditional way. And then you were also teaching an interdisciplinary subjects within which were called contextuals within your school, which would be multiple disciplines. And I think that I'm very much sort of formed by that doubleness, and it's what I like, really. I mean, I've always enjoyed being able to go to and fro between things that are a kind of broader, perhaps social sciences, philosophical kind of way of looking at things, and then the literary in the close reading sort of sense, and to try to see how they can impact on each other, and new ways of thinking can perhaps emerge by the conjunction of the two. So it's true that the two halves come out as rather different kinds of writing or reading, probably. But I, from where I sit, sort of having produced them in some sense, they're not different in the sense that I find I like to read closely in the sorts of texts that don't usually get close reading, the philosophical ones or the Daily Mail or whatever it might be. And I also like, when I'm reading literature, to think about the other more social kinds of questions that are the questions of the first half. So to me, they're not two separate things, even though they can appear to be in that way.
doesn't it make it a much greater challenge, though, to speak with authority about to analyze the way parenthood has been rethought with same-sex couples, single people being able to make use of reproductive technology, and really weighing up what that means. I can certainly see where that fits in literary analysis and in intellectual history and history of ideas, but haven't you just added a whole other weight of responsibility to yourself to speak with authority about those issues?
I think that is a difficulty, and I think probably using literary readings is a way of getting out of that difficulty some of the time, because then you can always sort of fall back on it being somehow the text that is doing the same for you in what you find or purport to find within the text. And I think that probably that is a kind of, or can be a kind of cop-out. But at the same time, the question is, who can speak with authority in these matters of, in a way, parenthood is one of those issues where sort of everyone and no one has authority, because who should have the right to adjudicate? One of the issues within reproductive technologies has been the problem of doctors, physicians being de facto the ones who get to decide, you know, whether the woman of 55 should be allowed to do IVF or something like that, and all kinds of different policies or non-policies have emerged in different countries of the world, depending on the kinds of health service that they have. And in a way, that's just come about in a sort of ad hoc way, without any kind of overall planning of who should say, or, you know, collectively, individually, whatever, who has the right to try to have a child in different circumstances. And then you talk about the ways that in different cultures it's assumed that different categories of person do or don't have the right to be parents, however that culture defines parenthood. And one of the things that interested me and brought me to the book, I think, was just how extremely rapidly in our own culture those norms have been changing of who can be considered a likely sort of person to be a parent, or the likely sort of couple to be a parental couple. And, you know, it's only in space of one generation, really, that we've gone from circumstances where the vast majority of parents were the married couple who was likely to be a lifelong married couple, producing by that time, you know, the proverbial 2.4 children, because they were a couple by then using contraception, most likely. And then you had the stigmatization of the unmarried mother, which is now not a phrase that you ever really
It's been hear. Largely passed over for it, other it, folk dolls.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And now all sorts of people or categories of person who wouldn't have been deemed likely parents, such as single individuals or gay couples or older women and so on, are found to be seeking parenthood
increasingly that is without opprobrium or comment, although there is still you know, the 62-year-old mother having a child, there is a certain tabloid press
there's always a demonizable or a sensationalizable extreme on the end. But the interesting thing is that the norms are moving all the time, so that, you know, it's only, say, 20, 25 years ago, the issue of gay parenthood was very much in question in a way that it isn't now, I think. And so you see this sort of shifting going on incredibly fast in historical terms, when the norm has been sort of, for as long as anyone can remember, that it's that the family is the family raised by the heterosexual married couple. Now, that's not to say that in practice that's what families were, because, I mean, until, again, pretty recently, until, say, the middle of the 20th century, the nuclear family, as we think of it, was not actually the norm in most Western countries, not because of divorce or separation, as would be the reason now, but because one or other parent was dying, and the remaining one then would remarry. So there would be lots of step-parents around and lots of step-siblings, as you get now, for different social reasons.
And your close reading in the second part of the book of these works of fiction show just how complex and changeable and mutable. A lot of the family setups we're looking at are Silas Marner, the elderly single man raising an adopted child, Jane Austen's Mansfield Park, a child being given away to an aunt and uncle to be raised, Great Expectations, all manner of parents, adoptive parents, hidden parents, unknown parents. As you say in the book, the nuclear ideal of the tidy 2.4 children really seems like a mid-20th century anomaly, or one that had greater weight in our minds than it did in reality.
And Great Expectations really has a lovely example of a seedling, because Miss Havisham, who we think of as this sort of, she is this the mad old lady sort of shut up in her house. I mean, she actually has actively sought to have a daughter. She gets an adopted toddler brought to her by the lawyer Jaggers. And once I started thinking about that aspect of Great Expectations, she's one of the adoptive parents. The other one is Magwitch, who adopts Pip. It did seem to be that it was a very significant part of the plot, which we kind of don't notice because we're looking at the sort of mainline story, which is the story of Pip and Estella and the story of childhood and the story of their failed love and all of those kinds of things. And the parental aspect gets kind of passed by as not central and not something that's mainstream to the plot. And I think that's a very common thing that happens with parental stories. I mean, there you have a driving force that Miss Havisham has actually done something in her life post her jilting. We think of her as having done nothing at all because she's just stuck there in her house.
Moldering away with her wedding dress and her wedding dress.
Yeah, but and so yet she's had a desire to have a daughter, and a daughter she has had. And she's brought her up, and brought her up in a fairly, compared with the rest of her life, in a fairly kind of culturally acceptable way. She's sent her off for finishing school and things like that. So there's a whole other Miss Havisham that you can just sort of miss, which is the Miss Havisham who has wanted to raise a child of her own and gone ahead and done it.
The whole startling point of this book, it seems to me, is that, and as our reviewer has said, your close readings turn an eye on something that we all seem to have passed over. I mean, that must be very satisfying as a literary scholar to look at works that have had endless amounts of critical consideration. And it's flipped those works on their head for me.
Well, that's lovely if you found that. And I haven't read the review yet, as you know, so I'm delighted if that's what she's found.
Are we so uninterested in parents? Are parents so dull and boring that even the authors of these books probably didn't realise they were giving us much in the way of details, because everyone wants to focus on young love or that romantic ideal of childhood, and yet the parents are there silently suffering or...
Well, I think you're quite right, because mostly we start life thinking of parents as dull and boring, because that's where we are and that's what they are, and it takes a lot of shifting about for them to get into another position in relation to that situation or that potential situation, which is what happens for adults. But it is a peculiar thing that parenthood is something so common and yet and so different from other kinds of human identity and human experience. I mean, however different parental experiences are, most parents would agree that it's something out of sync with any other thing that they do in their lives. And yet it doesn't really get its own stories very much. I mean, that's changing a bit. There are more stories, more if we're talking literature, more stories now
about
coming out about
parenthood
or from a distinctly parental point of view. But by and large, it does still tend to get kind of put in the background.
And yet, when you turn that sort of lens on these books, you see things that perhaps even as undergraduates we all realise that Silas Marner learned to love and to become a complete person when he was raising Eppie, and that his frozen old heart melted. and it's very, very touching. And furthermore, the fact that many works just scoot right past any issues of it. Jane and Rochester get married and their child is written off in half a sentence, as you point out.
Yeah.
So that all those stories are buried there.
Yeah. is or, it... Or there seems to be no issue that there might be a story that would then follow from Jane and Rochester having a child, or that there might have been a story before. I mean, you don't, what you don't get in any 19th century novels or other works is any question of what we now call planning for a baby, or thinking about whether they want or don't want a baby.
And that's agency all, was taken out of it, and
yeah,
it was just natural.
That's all very modern, and the issue of it being a question, or the issue of parenthood being something separable from a marital relationship or any other kind of relationship. Whereas now, I think parenthood has become sort of a lifestyle choice in its own
now,
right.
That phrase lifestyle choice is often a very
phrase, yes.
loaded,
yes.
tabloid-esque a sense of criticism, but it seems to me in the first half of the book you very evenly discuss these changes in reproductive choice and different family setups without any sense of judgment or that it involves selfishness. So when you say lifestyle choice, you obviously don't intend any weight of criticism to attach to it.
No, because I think that that's the way our culture is now, that it's presented in terms of choices to be made between a sort of, I mean, this is a caricature, but as if it's a sort of menu of options and possibilities from which we take some and not others. I mean, that's the kind of, it's not that lives work out like that, but that the ideology of what a life is increasingly presented in terms of options or choices, and also that those choices are to lead to some sort of individual fulfilment. And so it seems that within that framework that it fits, that parenthood should come to fit in with that model. I mean, I'm not saying that in the way people actually experience it or live their lives, that's how it is, but it seems a sort of natural, culturally natural development that it should have come to figure in that way. And, you know, just if you look at websites, it's become a sort of cliche of the fertility industry, that the websites for choosing, when people do this, went for choosing surrogate mothers or for choosing egg donors or something, or sperm donors. They look,
and you do a lot
like
of unpicking of the language.
They
around
look like
that.
Dating websites, because that's it's almost it's a parallel sort of presentation that you're picking fit people to.
That
do
sounds very unnerving. That,
yes.
That, but of course, you talk about wet nurses in an
yes.
earlier era, and there were perhaps parallel concerns. Now you want,
yes.
if you're looking for an egg
yes.
donor, you want a blonde Ivy League successful young woman,
yes.
Who is intelligent if she's donating genetic material to the process. And there were concerns about wet nurses, that they might drink too much or neglect children, that they might in some way be substandard mentally, morally, or biologically. Is that an outgrowth of, you know, is that just a progression of the same sorts of concern?
Well, the wet nurse issue is very much part of a history of usually the exploitation of other women's bodily biological labour for producing the children of the more wealthy, although wet nursing is a complicated history because it was also working class women who resorted to using wet nurses when they themselves had to go out to work, and so they needed to put their babies somewhere and earn a little bit more themselves than what they were paying to the wet nurses.
Not dissimilar to working women now who
find
they're paying as almost as much to babysitters
exactly.
as they're earning themselves.
Yeah.
There is certainly a sense of unease as I was reading your
yeah.
your close analysis of the way language is used to describe full surrogacy,
yes.
partial surrogacy,
yes.
the fact that you may have a mother who carries a child to term who is not her biological child.
Yeah.
Is there a sense that on some level there is still guilt and unease associated with these processes? When I think of people I know who have used surrogates
yes.
to give birth to children and the emotional complications involved. Does it all come down on women's head in the end to either do the biological labour or to suffer the anxiety about legitimacy, about relying on other women for something that they might feel guilty about?
I think there are enormous complications, and it's not something to which anyone is able to come up with a simple solution. I mean, we're now in a world in which surrogacy and egg donation are, if not at all common, becoming increasingly practicable. And as you know, there's a whole globalization dimension.
It's being exported to cheaper countries.
It's being exported to cheaper countries, and the consumer, the potential parents, are able to put together packages by which they can, you know, get your egg donor from one country, an egg donor who may look like you, and then have your surrogate in somewhere like India, where the surrogacy is much cheaper, and where the surrogate mother then gets to use her earnings to buy a house. And it's very uncomfortable, because it's to do with the separation of intense biological parental functions between different individuals in different parts of the world, and the exploitation of labour by wealthy countries in poorer countries. And that's again something which is a very old story, but coming out in new ways with these new technological possibilities. I mean, surrogacy has always attracted the most criticism as a practice, I think, because pregnancy is such a long-term commitment for the woman who undertakes it. It's not, I mean, egg donation isn't particularly pleasant, but it's not something that actually affects the woman's life over a long period. And I think that, again, we haven't really thought through in the implications of the developing fertility industry in a global sense.
And there are strong commercial interests in presenting it like a dating website,
exactly.
Like being a completely normal procedure, and yet we see that in some countries children born as a result of artificial insemination have the right to find their biological father without going too bleak and tabloid about it. There's a certain sense that it's storing up difficulties that the mere fact of there being technology to address it has not removed those potential problems.
You're talking about this country, where now if a child is born by donor insemination of sperm or egg, when that child reaches the age of 18, they do have the right to find out identifying information about that parent, in inverted commas. And of course that has led to a reduction in the available donors, and it's also the donation is not something that is remunerated in this country. So that's been another sort of push for potential parents of donor children to go abroad to jurisdictions where there aren't those constraints. But it's a kind of inexorable, a sense of an inexorability about a process, that once these technical possibilities are there, then somehow there's going to be a place where you can go and make use of them. And it's very hard to regulate things on an international level.
Of course, these issues about real parenthood versus adoptive parenthood, long before any of this technology existed, some of the works you look at in this book talk about who has the right to call themselves a real parent. Is it the person who raised you, as in the case of Silas Marner with Epi, or is it her no-good-neck father who turns up later and wants to claim her, and his wife says to him, well, if only we'd known about her, we could have raised her as our own child. And Epi, to I remember my youthful satisfaction, stuck with Silas Marner. But again, the issues in Mansfield Park, should the heroine love her parents who didn't seem that keen on her for whatever reason, or should
her
she
dad
care
just sits and reads the newspaper when she goes back after 18 years?
I think a lot of us remember that, though. Even those of us without adoptive uncles. These were issues that were already being teased through, and were issues of concern in ages of adoption. So I suppose that points to the fact that children will always want to know about their biological parents, but people are still able to speak up for who they feel is the person who has mothered or fathered them in the sense that is meaningful to them.
Yes, but I suppose there has been a change in the sense of what it counts to be a biological parent or the child biologically of so-and-so. And one of the effects of the new technologies has been to multiply the possible parents that any given child can have biologically. So, you know, if a child is born by egg donation, it's going to have two mothers, two biological mothers, the one who provided the egg and the one in whose womb it grew, which will be its postnatal mother, or a child born by surrogacy, it's the same thing the other way around, that its mother will be the one who provided the egg, perhaps, if it's that kind of surrogacy.
And then
the surrogate mother is not going to raise it afterwards. So that with that kind of doubling of the maternal biological function, which has always been, you know, theoretically the case, now practically a possibility, it complicates greatly the formerly relatively simple question of knowing your biological parents, because which ones are you going to regard as your biological parents?
You talk in the book a little bit about the difference of mothering and fathering and how we use those words, and it gradually being, you know, a fathering being the sense of siring children and mothering being something that you can do to anyone, child, colleague, friend, and that now it's been replaced by a more neutral term, parenting. Do you think that's a gain, or is that a linguistic obfuscation?
Well, parenting, I think, is a word that's more used to do with the kind of hands-on bringing up of the baby. And I think it's a relatively new word. By relatively new, I mean sort of the last 30 years or so. And it strikes me as a very interesting word, because it's not making a distinction between mother and father in the idea of who has the responsibility or the commitment to being with the child and doing stuff with the child or thinking about the child's education, whichever thing it may be, that those are kind of mutually the functions of both parents, whereas previously you might have had quite firm separations of paternal roles and maternal roles. So what interests me is different ways in which there's been a kind of relative equalisation or rapprochement between what used to be separate functions for the father and the mother, both biologically and socially. And by biologically, I mean that once upon a time, not so long ago, the father thing was that the idea that the father is always uncertain. We can never know a father for certain, as even in Homer's Odyssey, it is said, because there was no way of proving it. Well, with DNA now, you can know a father for certain, whereas the biological mother, as we were just discussing, has acquired a new kind of uncertainty, because those functions of the womb and the egg can be distributed between two different female bodies. So whereas from time immemorial it could always be said before that you know the mother because the mother is the body from whom the baby emerges, now that's not proven. So there is a way in which parenthood has become, that's why I made the book about parental stories rather than either mothers or fathers, or I wanted to put it there as a question about the ways in which those two things have now come together in a way that they haven't been together before as a function.
Maybe that greater uncertainty about who constitutes your mother will lead us further toward considering that the person who chooses to be your parent and who performs the
yes.
function of being a parent
yes.
and raises you and cares for you is the person who matters.
Yes.
You know, it could be a positive rather than
oh, yeah.
a negative thing. And those points were already being made in a literary sense, again with Silas Marner.
Yeah.
That even
slightly
Pip,
more
Pip
awkwardly,
and Pip, yeah, in Pip, Park, yes, yeah. and Pip and Magwitch.
Yeah.
Although obviously it's a terribly sad story, but Pip
yeah.
comes to realize that the person who had been causing all manner of possibilities to occur for him, who'd been supporting him secretly financially, was Magwitch, someone he... I wonder if that story of appreciating the parent you ignored is more resonant to readers when they become parents. Not that, of course, that most readers are transported to Australia.
Well, yes, and I suppose with Pip, there's a kind of double thing, because the other parent that he has had, who has been his loving parent,
is Joe,
who isn't his parent, is his brother-in-law, technically, because he's been raised by his much older sister. So Pip is sort of twice adopted in a way, because his sister and her husband first raise him in their extremely different ways from each other, and then there's the Magwitch distraction.
There are quite a lot of loving fathers or chosen fathers in the literature you're looking at.
I did start to worry about that, actually, because it was...
Well, of course, we can all think of the terrible domineering fathers of literature, but it's quite a dad positive selection, really.
I think I wanted to get away from the tyrannical father image, because, well, it's certainly there, but I mean, if I was going to think of parents as the parents in a nuclear family, which is what the book's mainly about, or the choosing parents of some sort, then the distant tyrants didn't quite figure in the same way as they do in some sort of more
they were gothic all glowering things, somewhere else.
But it's true that the book is rather full of kind of maternal fathers, maternal in the sense
and
of
in
those
fact,
functions that used to be
Silas Marner is described in just those terms as being almost like a mother to the child.
Well, yes, and he actually insists on doing everything
and turns down the
himself.
Help of a woman
of
who
a
might
woman
be able to
who,
do it
who
for
would,
him.
Who would have done it for him, yes.
Yes, he's quite a new man. you talk about the peculiarity of parenthood. Does it seem more peculiar to you now as a parent than it did before you were a parent?
Probably differently peculiar. I mean, I think it's one of those cliches that you expect parenthood to change your life, but the way that it changes your life is never the way you might have expected, and for everybody that is probably a different story. And I think also I shouldn't overstate that there are probably people who remain relatively untouched by the parenthood they find themselves in. For many fathers, and probably quite a lot of mothers, that may have been the case much more in the past, when it wasn't expected that the actual parents would be always the
for certain
on
classes
for
if
certain
you were
classes, exactly.
Sending them off to boarding school or to wet nurses, perhaps it wasn't quite such a life changer. So how has it changed things for you as a scholar, as a person? Has it made you more interested in certain themes?
I think I was interested in parenthood as a topic long before I thought I wanted to be a parent, which may be interesting in another way.
You have two girls.
I do, yes. Because when I first started teaching in the 80s, one of the themes that was always coming up was issues about feminism and psychoanalysis, and a lot of arguing that now seems very much of that period about what did Freud really say about women, and does feminism need psychoanalysis, or is psychoanalysis a terrible thing for feminism? And
you would be on the pro-psychoanalysis side,
I think so. But one of the things that really was almost a kind of avoided subject in all those debates was motherhood. I mean, it would have been motherhood then in relation to psychoanalysis, the choice for women to have or not have a child. It seemed that from a feminist point of view, it was more or less taken for granted that, oh, well, you know, you don't have children. And Freud had some things to say about female parenthood.
You say that you point out in the book that he separated the sort of desire for a sexual relationship to...
Yeah.
The desire for motherhood in women, but he doesn't seem to have considered the same thing for men.
Well,
that it wasn't an active choice, fatherhood. It just sort of came about as a result of this sex drive.
He makes it into an issue for women. That it's not a natural instinct for women to want to be mothers. And so in that sense, he's quite radical. But he's not radical from another point of view, in that for him, the becoming a mother is a way of getting a sort... If you're the mother of a boy, is a way of getting a kind of compensatory masculinity that you don't get in another way, so that parenthood or motherhood isn't something that has a meaning or a value for itself. It represents something else.
A surrogacy.
And that's exactly, that's something else that it represents is in fact masculinity, which is what the woman is constantly wishing for and can never actually have. So that's the kind of the awkward side of Freud, which can be kind of rehabilitated by saying, well, what he's doing is saying that women in a patriarchal society is put in that position where she can only acquire a sort of subordinate and compensatory substitute for what men are able to aspire to on their own terms. It was interesting to me in that period, in the 80s, when psychoanalysis was a kind of put in relation to feminism in that way, that one direction that we never went in was to think about the implications of the new reproductive technologies, which were very much in the news then. I mean, they were not at all widespread in their use, but there were these whole new methods for making babies, if you like, that were changing the actual facts of life. I mean, the possibilities for having babies. I mean, it was a very radical thing, and it was instead of being to do with the choice not to have a child or a woman's right to choose in that negative sense, here was a new possibility that was for parents of both sexes, taking it for granted that the having of a child was something to go to great lengths to achieve. And the question was really never raised about what is the meaning of the wish to have or the wish not to have a child, whether for men or for women in that context. And to go back to your original point at the very beginning of this, it is interesting that though Freud does give some attention to where does a woman's wish when she has it to have a child come from, he never seems to raise that question at all in relation to men. I mean, it's taken for granted that a man who has reached a stage of heterosexual normality, in quotes, not that that's a simple thing for him to do, that man will go ahead and have children. That's just not an issue about does he or doesn't he wish to have a child. That's only an issue for the woman, for Freud.
Now, you mentioned that with the rise in new kinds of reproductive technology, perhaps that will change our way of looking at parenthood. And you mentioned in passing as well that perhaps that's starting to be reflected in literature. The works that you focus on here, besides those from the classical era, go up to Edith Wharton's wonderful Roman Fever. I wonder whether you think of any works of contemporary literature that seem interesting to you in terms of their presentation of parenthood, whether it's, say, Lionel Shriver's We Need to Talk About Kevin,
yes,
or Herman Bloch's The Dinner, which is about a best-selling Dutch novel where parents have to confront the fact that their nicely raised middle-class children have burned someone to death. And the issue about it's a
yeah.
very interesting look at how the mother and father decide will they turn their child in to the police, and how the conflicting urges of being loyal to your children and loyal to your marriage go on. I mean, obviously this is an interest of yours. When you're writing a book, I suppose you see, it's, people say when you're buying a car, you start to see the brand you're looking for everywhere. If you're writing a book about parenthood, are you conscious of interesting portrayals of it even outside the terms of your book?
I think there is a whole crop of books about parents who find they've raised if not
the
terrorists,
monstrous
the monstrous child. I mean, we need to talk about Kevin is one of them. There's also a novel by Philip Roth. I can't remember if it's American Pastoral, but I think it is in American Pastoral, where a daughter is a member of an extreme organisation. And then there's a novel by Carol
Shields.
Exactly.
As a good Canadian, I would have
exactly.
To know that.
I was about to say, nervously say Canadian. That called Unless, where again, these aren't terrorist children, but the child who has, in an extreme way, moved away and moved off to another kind of life.
And it's told from the perspective of
the parent,
exactly. Whereas
the
literature you're looking at here, in many cases, has the omniscient narrator, but it's really not on the parent's side. It's focused on the child in many cases.
Yeah. So instead of the sort of classic thing of the child now turned adult point of view of blaming the parents for, you know, look what you made me, it's now the parents' point
the
of view.
The Philip Larkin.
What did I do? Or did I do it?
And so Philip Larkin, had he been born later,
would have had a child.
Yes. His famous lines about your mum and dad would have been about your child.
Yeah.
Is
it's what the child does to the parent by turning out who they are.
I wonder, though, is that a reflection of the fact that popular fiction, many readers are of the baby boomer generation or slightly younger, they are parents.
Yeah.
It reflects concerns about the time being out of joint. The idea that you could give birth to a monstrous child in some way reflects that sense of the enemy within. Or is it all Louise Brown's scientist?
But it's also at some minimal level the sense that it's what the child becomes is more than, maybe more than or different from what the parents put into the child. So, I mean, there is the open question of did the parents do it to them, or did the culture do it to them, or something else, which is one way these novels are looking at it, I think. But there's also a crop of novels that are, you know, to put it crudely, sort of IVF novels, sort of novels about the quest even just to have a child in the first place, and becoming its own plot. And
sure, the marriage plot, obviously not such a driving force in fiction, but the IVF plot.
Yeah.
I wonder if there will be more of that. Even the normalisation of watching popular television and there are gay couples who have an adopted child or a surrogate child.
Exactly,
it passes almost without comment.
It's one plot amongst others, and the how to get a baby in various modes. And it can even be done as infertility as a kind of comedy. So there's Ben Elton's novel Inconceivable that becomes Maybe Baby, a successful movie. And
you mentioned all the terrible puns about conception and Inconceivable. And for those of us who write headlines from time to time, I can tell you I was blushing on behalf of all of those people who named those books. Presumably when you look at language that closely, the world is never dull. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Karen.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.